Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme is the COVID-19 pandemic narrative. Who has captured it? Why has it been weaponized? How are they politicizing it? Who can we believe? What is the true story? Do we still have a pandemic? Should we be waiting for the miracle vaccines that are coming, or the very unique original drugs? Why aren't we looking at prevention? Why aren't we looking at natural immunity? Why aren't we looking at what we can do rather than simply waiting passively and helplessly to be infected and possibly, depending upon comorbidities, to become sick and then die? I have yet to see any national effort to explain to the American public how their immune system works in health and disease, what it means to have been infected earlier in life with other COVID viruses, and how that can also help protect us today. I have yet to see discussions on how vitamin D and vitamin C and vitamin A and other nutrients like zinc and even herbs like astragalus can help us fortify our immune system. It's in the peer-reviewed literature. Why aren't they discussing this? Why are they attacking so aggressively the use of hydroxychloroquine and zinc and zithromycin? We have so many reports that it's beneficial. Why do they say it's not beneficial and it's dangerous? These are the issues that we have to address. To do this addressing from Germany via Zoom is my guest, Dr. Sucharit Bhakti. He is an American-born physician trained in Germany and has been in the medical field now for 50 years, five decades. He received his medical degree from the University of Bonn and did his postdoctoral work at the prestigious Max Planck Institute of Immunobiology and Epigenetics before becoming an associate professor at the Institute of Medical Microbiology at Gießen University. Later, he was appointed as the chair of medical microbiology at the University of Mainz. He has published over 300 articles in the fields of immunology, bacteriology, and virology, and has received numerous awards, including the Order of Merit of Rhineland. His recent book, co-written with his biologist wife, Dr. Karina Reiss, Corona False Alarm, Facts and Figures, which has been written for the lay person to understand the pandemics and its truth and its lies. And it's very clear. It's already become a national bestseller in Germany and is rapidly receiving international attention. Now we're going over to Germany and say hello to Bhakti. Nice to be with you today. Thank you for being on our program.
Hello. Glad to be with you today.
We're delighted you could return to our program. Much has happened since you were here last on the program back on October 6th, just a few days after your book was released in the United States. I would encourage listeners to hear that interview that can be found in our archives at prn.fm. I would like to begin with the main headline that has hijacked the media's attention, and that is the high rate of efficacy the drug companies are reporting for their COVID-19 vaccines. After you were on the program, we have seen that Pfizer and Moderna are claiming 94 to 95% efficacy for their mRNA vaccines, and now AstraZeneca is also reporting similar claims. In my personal opinion, these numbers are suspect. Here in the United States, a mad rush is underway to make it available in less than a month. Dr. Anthony Fauci is giving people hope that if enough people get vaccinated, we will reach herd immunity and the pandemic will come to an end. However, we still do not know the safety profile for any of these vaccines, aside from what the vaccine companies want to tell us in public relations releases. There have been no peer-reviewed scientific reports detailing how these studies were conducted. I'll give you a few of my concerns I would like for you to address, please. When they select patients for the or people to be in their studies, do they exclude people that would otherwise be using the vaccine in real life? For example, people with cancer, autoimmune diseases, heart disease, congestive heart failure, emphysema, Alzheimer's, dementia, diabetes. Now, when you add all these together, you're dealing with approximately one half the entire American population. So if you do not have those individuals represented in your study group, then what does it say if you only allow healthy people, younger healthy people, into your study, exclude sick people, and yet it's the very sick people you intend to have vaccinated? Something to me says this is wrong, this is unethical, and it's bad science. I'd like your input on that. And then the data is being collected right now about the way that they've conducted these trials, and also the third phase trials have been on only for a couple of months. Well, under normal conditions, it takes at least 5 years post-vaccine research to see what are the long-term impacts of a vaccine. There is no time. We're going right from the development right into the marketplace with maybe in some cases a month or less. Some of these vaccine companies are already going into production, even though there is no long-term safety studies. There's not even a short-term safety study. There's not even animal testing. How can we possibly consider this safe and effective? And that's what all the media is saying. Oh, it's safe and effective. Yet we have no safety data, and we have no efficacy data based upon understanding how they conducted these studies. So please give us your analysis and concerns about the rapid race to bring these vaccines to public. The forum is yours.
Well, what you said was actually what I would have said. So I would continue from there to say that the reports coming now from BioNTech and AstraZeneca and Moderna are not suspect to me. They are blatantly obvious. And it is obvious that these studies and the reports on the studies are rigged so that they can, become licensed, be passed as vaccines in this record time. You see, if you look at people under 70 who do not have pre-existing diseases, and these were the volunteers that received the vaccine, all right? As John Ioannidis published mid-October, I believe, and that has been put on the WHO bulletin. So it's a peer-reviewed paper from probably the leading epidemiologist in the world at Stanford. And he clearly said that, you know, the infection fatality rate for people under 70 years is less than 0.1%. Now, you have to say this very slowly to understand what it means. It means that 5 out of 10,000 infected individuals have died with or because of the virus. So, in fact, there were also people with pre-existing diseases in these fatal cases. Now, I ask you, the listener, how do you think you are going to be able to show that a vaccine is efficacious if 99.9% of the infected individuals are not dying? All right, over 99.9% are not dying. The answer is you can't. There is no way to show efficacy. So then if people are saying these vaccines are 90% efficacious, how did they ever show that? Did they show that by demonstrating that the vaccine protected at least from severe disease. Severe disease is the COVID-19. It's not a cough, not a little bit of fever, you know, and it certainly is not a positive PCR, because as we know today, the value of this PCR test as it is being conducted is virtually zero. And especially at this time of the year, the PCR test taken alone as, you know, the criteria for infection is simply not, it doesn't work. You have nothing. The PCR test tells you nothing, therefore you have no data at all. Now, the last thing I heard was that, in fact, BioNTech, after having vaccinated so many thousands of people, found out that 9 individuals in the non-vaccinated group, I think the number was 9, got severe disease. However, I don't know how that was defined. Was it defined by the clinical symptoms plus a valid PCR test or not? That they don't say. Now, in the other group, in the vaccinated group, 1 individual of the many thousands became seriously ill with a positive PCR test. So that's where you have your 90% efficacy. My goodness gracious. This is so simply, well, I think that people are just being led to statements that are not backed up by any science whatsoever. And this is what is supremely, supremely disturbing and worrisome, because we now do have the feeling that the whole agenda is being driven by this vaccine craze. I think it's a craze. Because, you know, if the infection fatality rate for individuals under 70 years is 0.05%, this means who in the world under 70 years should get the vaccine at all? And my answer is, no one in his right mind should want to have this vaccine. So if you're taking out all the under 70 year olds in the world, or in Germany, you've already lost 2/3 or 70% of the individuals whom this vaccine was created for. Because as you know, it has been announced, I think, yes, Bill Gates announced it on German television, that 7 billion people in the world should receive this vaccine. 7 billion. Now, if you go around vaccinating people who are not going to die in the first place with a vaccine that has not gone through any of the really required safety checks, experiments, preclinical experiments, animal experiments, these have not been done. There's a very simple saying: if you want trouble, if you ask for trouble, you're going to get trouble. And now the world is being persuaded into asking for big trouble, huge trouble, just unimaginable trouble, because as you probably also know, these vaccines that are intended for use in Europe and in America, Moderna, are a totally novel type of vaccine. They are gene-based. One doesn't receive the conventional vaccine anymore, which is parts of the virus. One is now receiving the virus gene itself. This is a very frightful thought, you know. Go around injecting a foreign gene into a human body. This has never been done before. And if you go around meddling with nature in this fashion, you know, in Germany, if we want to do animal experiments of any sort, you have to write pages and pages of applications. That takes hours and days and days. And if you want to do genetic experiments, you take weeks to write the application because they're so damn difficult to get through the committees. Now, we are witnessing trials with gene-based vaccines. So what is happening is that experiments are now being performed on humans. And I don't know why anyone in his right mind would want to get to take part in this experiment, which is entirely unnecessary because this virus is not going to kill you. And modern medicine is well set up to deal with this virus. Don't you think, none of you listening, that modern medicine is so bad that we can't deal with a virus that is not more dangerous than a flu virus? It's just another family of viruses like the flu. So you have the flu virus and you have the coronaviruses. And these are the two big families of viruses that are known not to be killer viruses. That's why they have been able to coexist with us throughout history, the history of mankind. That's why these viruses are so successful. They don't want to kill you, and they don't kill you. So the people who are really endangered are those with pre-existing illnesses, as now the whole world knows. The pre-existing illnesses are obesity. It's not an illness, but anyone who's obese is not healthy in his body. You just don't see the diseased part. People with coronary heart disease, dementia, of course, because the dement people need a lot of care. And if you don't take care of them, they have no chance. People with cancer, people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, smokers. These are the people you want to take care of, yes. And for these, there's nothing to be said against a vaccine if it works, first, and if it is safe, second. Now, I have been working in this field all my life, infectious diseases, immunology. I was also, once upon a time, involved in the development of a vaccine. But that's another story. So I know a little bit about this, and I can tell you there is no way. There is no way to get those safety trials done in months. Never, ever believe it. And if you don't believe it, then you must realize that by volunteering to have this vaccine, you are participating in the largest human experiment ever conducted on Earth. I mean, the experiment that is being conducted now, of course, is the experiment with the lockdown, all the lockdown measures. These are experiments on humans, you know, forcing people to wear masks, forcing young people to wear masks. No one ever has looked at what terrible things can happen to those poor children wearing masks. And they are going to happen. And anyone who doesn't believe it has to either start reading up on medicine, physiology, or they just have to shut up. Okay. Yes. Anything
else? I appreciate that overview. Oh, we have a lot more to discuss. I was looking at the peer-reviewed scientific literature. I wanted to see what does the actual science say about not doing a vaccine, but rather doing an accepted medication that is FDA approved, that has been used over 4 billion times, at least that is what's recorded by people, throughout its long 65-plus year history. It is safe. It's hydroxychloroquine in combination with zinc and zithromycin, an antibiotic. And so the first thing we hear when, unfortunately, Trump used it, and then I believe that part of the idea was, let's attack him and in the process attack hydroxychloroquine, because several years ago, Anthony Fauci actually did a supported research on hydroxychloroquine showing that it worked. But in this case, I believe this is where the politicalization and weaponization of the COVID pandemic for political and ideological means superseded correct scientific exploration. So they said hydroxychloroquine is dangerous, it kills people, has no benefit whatsoever. And they published two major articles. There were six articles published, but two of them were the basis for the others. And it was one in the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, and the other in New England Journal of Medicine. Both of them were retracted. Why? Because they were false. So then we were told, well, still don't use it. And doctors have not been allowed to use it in almost 90% of the United States. It's still used around the world. But it was so easy to use that in France, they didn't even have it by prescription. So here is what the actual peer-reviewed literature shows. This is not hearsay. It's not conspiracy theory. It's fact. I have found 179 articles in the scientific literature on hydroxychloroquine. 114 of those articles are peer-reviewed. That's a huge number on a given topic. In the early treatment, 100% of the studies report a positive effects of a minimum of 64% in the medium improvement. Now, that's a very high rate in the first 7 days of giving a low-potency hydroxychloroquine combination. It's actually the zinc that's doing most of the work there. But 64%. And in late treatment, 76% of studies reported positive effects in 28%. So it's not that it doesn't work later in treatment. It depends upon other comorbidities and what other medical treatments have been used and at what potency. So what do we find out? Here's what's very important. I'm going to ask you to address this, please. When we looked at the potencies used in early treatment, it was from 2 to 400 milligrams once or twice a day, depending upon the physician, and preventatively once a week to once a month at 400 milligrams. For those who died at the end stage of their life, generally with respirators, they had an accumulation of 7 to 9,000 milligrams in their body. Now, the peer-reviewed literature shows that the toxic level is 5,000 milligrams. So they were not looking at what the actual toxicological data was saying. Don't go above 5,000 milligrams. And they were. And those are the patients that died. But if you kept it at low dose, even in late stage treatment, you still get 28% efficacy. That's better than any drug they have now. But 64% was the medium, and some physicians are claiming 90 to 100% success. Several had hundreds of patients. One had 1,200 patients. Not a single patient has died. And this physician, who's a cardiologist, said that at low doses, it has no impact upon the heart. That was another scare tactic. So now when I look at these studies and I go through them and I'm looking at the journals they're published in, these are all highly respected journals like Thrombosis and for example, a positive study in Medical Rx. These are all mainstream, and you see 80% positive preventing death. And in the prevalence of diabetes management outcome among COVID-19, and this was in a peer-reviewed journal. So I'm looking at all these positive. Now, there are only a handful of negatives out of all these, just a handful, and those were because they were using too high a dosage. And so I actually have the full list right in front of me, and I'm going to post it on PRN.fm. So no longer do you have to listen to the New York Times give you a false narrative or Anthony Fauci give you a biased narrative, you have to look to see what are positive, what are negative. In fact, in the one here, they were comparing it with hydroxychloroquine and vitamin C. But unfortunately, this was not in a controlled environment. These were in people's homes. But the positives are substantial. So we're posting it. So here is my larger question with that as a background. Why aren't we promoting something such as this? There are four other drugs, but this is a FDA-approved drug. It's been used safely to prevent malaria or treat malaria and other conditions. And it is showing positive proof by a lot of physicians using it around the world. And yet, it is not allowed in the United States and places. We're attacking it instead of promoting it. And if we did this, then we wouldn't need a vaccine. Your thoughts, please.
Agree with you. It is known to people who have looked at this, like you and like us, that of course the deaths were due to overdose of this hydroxychloroquine. This high dose was being promoted at one time by many, many experts and official agencies. I won't mention any names. And they actually were promoting such high doses that it was bound to fail. And that's what happened. So people were dying because they got a hydroxychloroquine overdose, which will always happen. I mean, if you and I took an overdose, we would also die. Now, there's one other angle to this, and that is the angle of this enzyme deficiency that leads to favism. 1/6 of the Asian population, I think about 1/3 of the Hispanic population, has this gene defect, which makes them oversensitive to hydroxychloroquine. So clearly, if you're going to administer hydroxychloroquine to these people with potential gene defects, one has to be very, very careful, all right? Otherwise, you could get into deep water with those patients as well. And there are many, many patients in the world that have this gene defect and will not tolerate hydroxychloroquine. I come from a country where 1/6 of the populace has this gene defect. And at the time that hydroxychloroquine was being used to treat malaria, they emerged as a very susceptible group that would suffer because of this treatment. So apart from these, however, the hydroxychloroquine plus zinc used at the correct dose would probably be excellent, for sure. You know, there's probably a reason why this works too. I was befriended with the discoverers of how hydroxychloroquine works when viruses like the flu virus wants to infect a cell and enter the cell and then multiply in the cell. And this was back in the beginning of the 80s, almost 40 years ago. And there were Finns, actually, two of the most brilliant scientists and cell biologists that the world has seen. And I learned from them. They did such beautiful experiments. I want to tell you of these experiments now because they are not known anymore. You know, when a virus enters the cell, I think you can see me, right? Yes?
Yes.
When the virus goes into the cell, then the first thing that has to happen is that it has to inject its gene, nucleic acid, into the cytosol. So the virus goes in and then it, oh no, it's going to be too difficult for me to explain how to do this. So just take my words as they come. The virus has to inject its gene into the cytosol. And for this, it has to fuse its membrane with the in with the membrane of an envelope that it is encased within. Okay, so it's in an envelope and it has to inject it through the envelope. So its membrane has to fuse. And this fusion process is actually performed by the spike, that protein that is now being used as a vaccine, it uses to bind to the cell in the first place. And this event of fusion and injection of the gene of the virus into the cell is dependent on acid. So it needs to come into a sour environment. Now, hydroxychloroquine is the opposite. Hydroxychloroquine neutralizes acid because it's basic. So these brilliant fins, they showed beautifully, if you put hydroxychloroquine on a cell that is infected with the influenza virus, with the flu virus, the virus cannot inject its genome into the cell, and therefore the cell is not infected, okay? The virus enters, but it can't be multiplied. I don't know whether I made myself clear, but that was the gist of a great discovery that made them world famous 40 years ago.
Are you familiar with what just was presented today by the British Medical Journal? The British Medical Journal's executive editor, let me quote this. This just is today, within the hour. Quote, politicians and governments are suppressing science. They do so in the public interest, they say, to accelerate availability of diagnostics and treatments. They do so to support innovation, to bring products to market at unprecedented speed. Both of these reasons are partly plausible. The greatest deceptions are founded in a grain of truth, but the underlying behavior is troubling. Science is being suppressed for political and financial gain. Wow. Let me repeat that. British Medical Journal, just an hour ago. Science is being suppressed for political and financial gain. COVID-19 has unleashed state corruption on a grand scale, and it is harmful to public health. Politicians and industry are responsible for this opportunistic embezzlement. So, too, are scientists and health experts. The pandemic has revealed how the medical-political complex can be manipulated in an emergency, a time when it is even more important to safeguard science. The UK's pandemic response provides at least four examples of suppression of science or scientists. First, the membership, research, and deliberations of the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, SAGE, are initially secret until a press leak forced transparency. The leak revealed inappropriate involvement of government advisors in SAGE while exposing underrepresentation from public health, clinical care, women, and ethnic minorities. Indeed, the government was also recently ordered to release a 2016 report on deficiencies in pandemic preparations. Operation Cygnus, following a verdict from the Information Commissioner's Office. Next, a Public Health England report on COVID-19 and inequalities. The report's publication was delayed by England's Department of Health. A section on ethnic minorities was initially withheld, and then following a public outcry, was published as part of a follow-up report. Authors from Public Health England were instructed not to talk to the media. Third, on October 15th, the editor of The Lancet complained that an author of a research paper, a UK government scientist, was blocked by the government from speaking to media because of a, quote, difficult political landscape, end quote. Now a new example concerns the controversy over point-of-care antibody testing for COVID-19. The Prime Minister's Operations Moonshot depends upon immediate and wide availability of accurate rapid diagnostic tests. It also depends on the questionable logic of mass screening currently being trialed in Liverpool with a suboptimal PCR test. Again, suboptimal PCR test, what you just said. The incident relates to research published this week in the British Medical Journal, which finds that the government procured an antibody test that in real-world tests falls well short a performance claim is made by its manufacturers. Researchers from Public Health England and collaborating institutions sensibly pushed to publish their study findings before the government committed to buying a million of these tests, but were blocked by the health department and the prime minister's office. Why was it important to procure this product without due scrutiny? That's just part of what is going on today. Quote, suppression of science and scientists is not new or a particularly British phenomena. In the United States, President Trump's government manipulated the Food and Drug Administration to hastily approve unapproved drugs, and it goes on from there, including remdesivir. And globally, people, policies, and procurement are being corrupted by political and commercial agendas. So, after all these months, finally, over 40,000 scientists and physicians have signed the declaration about the Burlington Proclamation, headed by the Great Burlington Declaration, by a professor from Stanford, Oxford, and Harvard. And now all these people are coming out and saying, yes, we've had enough of the corruption in science on this pandemic. Yes, the virus, it's real. Yes, it's killed people. Yes, it's easily spread. But everything else that you're doing and saying, from the PCR test to the lockdowns to the vaccinations to promoting expensive drugs that have no background and being proved safe or effective, and not using common sense and reason, is wrong. Please take it from there.
Wow. This was so thrilling to me. I would never, ever have thought that the British Medical Journal would publish this type of article, because they've been going mainstream as well. So I'm just so extremely exalted. I'm just happy, and I draw my hat and say, England's honor is being saved now by the English themselves. How wonderful and how impressive. What a good text. What a beautiful text. Yes, it's wonderful. You know, this Great Burlington Declaration was the outcome of there's an association named PANDA. Do you know about PANDA, anyone? No.
Yes.
PANDA is based in South Africa, and it was a group of people sort of feeling like, as we do, that the situation is unbearable. So they set up this group of workers, and PANDA stands for Pandemic Data Analysis, okay, PANDA. And it was their idea to invite people as the scientific advisors to create a scientific advisory board. And three of the four board members were the professor from Oxford, Harvard, and Stanford, who drew up this declaration. And the fourth in the advisory board is Professor Michael Levitt, the Nobel Prize winner. These four people are the ones that are responsible for this huge movement. And as you mentioned, 40,000 physicians around the world have signed this declaration, which says, in principle, that all the preventive measures going above normal have to be lifted immediately. There's no reason to keep on doing anything. And the focus for the future, not only for SARS-CoV-2, but for other infectious agents that attack the lungs of people who are at high risk because of pre-existing illnesses, must be that of protecting that group or those people. And a list has now been drawn up of how that is to be done. Now, All right. So I was actually also invited to join this advisory board. This was 6 weeks ago. So now I'm also one of the 5 members. And we've been working together to draw up an addendum to say what to do. And this is going to be released, I believe, I hope, within 1 or 2 weeks. And then the whole...
That's very exciting. I want to go back to a few, if I may, please. I want to get you focused on 3 issues before the end of our program. One is, right now, the New York Times and virtually all the publications in the United States are saying that if you get tested and more people are testing because of travel restrictions, especially around Thanksgiving, everybody wants to show that they don't have a positive test, so they're going to get tested. And unfortunately, they're using the PCR test. Tell us why the PCR test should not be used as a diagnostic test to determine if you're positive for COVID or you have a viral load or anything like that. And then they're saying that if you test positive, even if you're a young Olympian and healthy, but you might have had a previous virus, could have been months ago, even years ago, that now you're a positive case. So they're reporting it as a case, meaning someone who is actively sick, instead of simply someone who tested positive and possibly, more likely, falsely positive. So why are they gaming the system by calling someone who tests positive on an inaccurate test a case? Because it's saying you have high blood pressure. Tell us about it.
There's now a movement in Germany. Lawyers are standing up to say they're going to file suits against this. It's criminal. It's criminal. Simply that. Now this PCR test. I liken this, to a little box, black box for a magic box, and this box has a button. You press the button. Anything that the genes that are in that box are going to be multiplied, doubling in 1 minute. Okay, so every minute. The numbers are going to double. That's the principle of a PCR. It multiplies gene sequences, fragments of the gene of the virus. And you can go for one target, one gene sequence, or 2 gene sequences, and you press the button, and then every minute, that sequence doubles, the amount of the gene sequences, the numbers of the gene sequences double. So the big question is, if you have $1 and you press the button for 10 minutes, how many dollars do you have in the end? The answer is 1 million, okay? So that's that. If you say that you need to have $1 in the box at the beginning to be infected and to be infectious to your neighbors, all right? Then of course, if you keep the button pressed for 10 minutes, and you find out that you have $1 million, you can go back and calculate and say, oh yes, you were infectious. You had $1 in the box, all right? If you had only 1 cent in the box, after 10 minutes, you're going to have $10,000, which tells you that you were not infectious. You had bits and pieces of the gene perhaps stuck in your throat, but you didn't have enough virus. The viral load was not enough for you to become a danger to anyone because you were not infectious. Now, the definition of infectivity is not done in animal experiments, not done in experiments where you say another person is going to be infected. No, it's done by scraping this swab with the virus or the viral fragments on cell culture to see if there's enough virus to infect cells. You have to realize this. The definition of infectivity for this virus is whether it can infect cells, whether the dose is enough, which is ridiculous in the first place. But still, let's keep it that. Now, if you have had 1 cent in the box and you kept your finger pressed for 10 minutes, I told you would have $10,000. So if you stop pressing, that's okay. You can go and say you were not infective. You were not infectious. You didn't have the infection, all right? But If you keep on pressing that button for 7 more minutes, you're going to get $1 million, right? And this is the gist of why this PCR test has to be trashed. Because in the PCR test, one is allowed to press one finger as long as you want. You know, not only 17 minutes, even 20 minutes. And so it's lighting up to say, oh, you were positive. Although, if you had looked at the time that the finger was pressed, and this time, you know, is on the finding, the results tell you how long the time was, but they're not never reported. And this is also criminal, because without reporting the time, you can't make any conclusions about how much was in the box. Have I made myself clear, actually, or is it not?
Yes, let me just try to put this in lay language from a little different perspective. Normally, if there's a diagnostic done on you to determine if you have a glioblastoma or astrocytoma, cancers of the brain, you'll have a second opinion. You'll have different CAT scans, maybe MRIs. And so there'll be multiple looks to see, do you have the diagnosis? But with the PCR, it was never intended, and it's so stated. I filmed him stating this, Dr. Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize in Science for this discovery of the PCR. He said it's not to be used as a diagnostic for any virus because it's not looking for a whole virus. It's looking for a particle, and the particle could be something that you had a virus in the body, attacked it, and the body won, and your immune system won, and now that debris could be in there for years, even decades. But what they do is once they start seeing, doing the test, then they amplify it again and again and again and again and again. They keep blowing it up until, oh, after 45 different blow-ups, oh, now there we have a virus. But at that point, there's no way the virus is pathogenic. It's not going to hurt anyone. It goes against Koch's postulates. There's not enough of the virus in your body to cause you a problem. Now, a lot of scientists believe that you should cut off the amplification at 30 amplifications, meaning you've blown it up most, 30 times.
At most.
And that's it. Yeah, at the most. And they're doing it 40 times. So, of course, they're going to get false positive readings.
Terrible.
It's
being used to put the whole world in prison. You know, it's so utterly ridiculous that people don't understand this. One last comparison. If you go and get caught in an alcohol control test and you blow, and in Germany, if that needle goes up to 0.5 per mil, then you're in for it, all right? If it goes up to 0.05 per mil, of course you can keep on driving because you're not drunk. Now, the PCR test is similar because it's so sensitive that of course it will also be able to measure 0.005. But the difference to the alcohol breath test is that the moment anything is found, 0.005, which is meaningless, you're not drunk, you are classified as ill and you have to go to quarantine and you're classified as infectious. And this is so ridiculous that it is hard to believe that, you know, a normal citizen of the world who has gone through school cannot understand it and accepts it. Everyone has to stand up and say no.
Okay, final question. It'll take you a little time to answer this. You have a background of 50 years in science as a professor, as a chairman of a department, published 300 papers, immunology, and nowhere do I see a dialogue on what people can do to keep themselves strong, how exposing ourselves in the real world to different viruses. We've all been exposed to cold viruses, COVID viruses, and flu, influenza viruses. So our body is able to either have no symptoms or some symptoms. Some people have very bad symptoms. Some people die from the flu, influenza, and pneumonia. Mainly it's pneumonia. And the older you are, the weaker your immune system. So why, if our weakened immune system predisposes us to a worst outcome, and why do comorbidities that show really serious systemic disease like diabetes, heart disease, emphysema, dementia. Why is there not a single thing being done to help people overcome these comorbidities to prevent them or seek a proper medical treatment for them? Instead, everything is in everybody wait, don't change anything in your life except wash your hands, wear a mask, social distance, and just wait because we have a vaccine when there's so many other things we could do to help ourselves as we have historically.
For years, not only because of the corona, that, you know, the main causes of premature death. And when is death premature? You are dying a premature death if you have not reached 100 years age. Normal men are granted, their genome grants them around 105 years. This is known, you know. And women have 115 years if they take care of themselves. Of course, you never get to 100, you hardly ever get to 100% that other things will happen. But this life expectancy is only being, you know, fulfilled by about 70% at the moment. And this is the ridiculous thing about public health. People are not being told that the major causes of death are obesity with heart disease, which goes on, high blood pressure, diabetes, because they eat too much sugar, you know, I mean, and smoking. And that's that. And then, of course, you have cancer, but half of the cancer deaths can also be prevented by a healthy lifestyle, right? So if that were taken care of by the government, by the public health agencies, then they would be doing their job. But what they're doing now, it's just stupid. And also, they are just not fulfilling their duties. It's their duty to do it, and they're not doing it. Instead, they're saying, you know, lockdown, wear your mask, social distancing. How stupid can one get? How stupid? They don't tell people that it is this co-evolution that makes it possible for us to deal with new variants of these viruses, flu virus and coronaviruses, because our immune system has a very good memory. So our lymphocytes, it's not the antibodies that are so important, it's the lymphocytes that are important, which is something that people should know and don't know, unfortunately. And we took a great pains to explain these things in the book. And that my lymphocytes, if they have been, you know, doing sparing bouts with the coronavirus last year, and the new coronavirus comes along, because the new coronaviruses look very similar to the old, it's like, you know, when someone, if you have a child, a baby, the baby's born, the baby's a new human, it's a new human, but it's still a human. So the new coronavirus is also a new virus, but it's still a coronavirus. And this human looks like a human. And that coronavirus looks like a coronavirus. And our lymphocytes remember what coronaviruses look like. And therefore, they can take care of these infections very well. That is why the infection fatality rates are so low, almost zero. I mean, this is something you really have to think about. You know, when chicken are taking their bread in mass in huge houses, and they don't get to go outside, so they don't become infected with the flu virus, because the flu virus infects birds all the time, right? And birds, wild birds flying around, have an immune system that can deal with these flu viruses that come and go and come and go, like coronaviruses. And what is well known is that if these flocks of chicken held, you know, hundreds of thousands in one huge, hall, if the flu virus then comes to them, then you can really be in trouble. You can lose all the chicken because they have no immunity left. And this has become one of the reasons why the bird flu has wreaked so much havoc among the chicken breeders in
factory farming. Doctor, we're out of time, unfortunately. Oh. I want people to read Corona False Alarm, Facts and Figures, by my guest, Dr. Sucharit, that's Sucharit Bhakdi, and that is Bhakdi, along with his wife, Karina Reis, R-E-I-S-S, Corona False Alarm. I look forward to our next conversation. Thank you very much for being out there, and thank you, after 50 years of an impeccable career, having the courage to stand up to the establishment and the corruption in science today, and the Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci's, and say, I will not go along with this false narrative. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.